and the soul, and just has to be reawakened. And then, so I quoted this famous verse. Is there a volunteer who would like to read it, please? Raise your hand. Famous from the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. What's interesting is, as we sing, we glorify Prabhupada as Bhakti Vedanta. Anta means the end of, right? Bhakti Veda. Veda means knowledge, or the Vedas, which is knowledge. And so the goal, the end of the Veda is bhakti, right? Is love, love for God. So in our tradition, there's really not much difference between knowledge and love of God. Because knowledge ultimately leads to love of God and is love of God, right? And so what's the best example from Vrindavan? Who in Vrindavan are the best examples of? Yeah, the maidens of Vrindavan, who are illiterate, who have no knowledge, who have no education, but they have the greatest love for Krishna. And so they have, in that sense, the greatest knowledge. So it's interesting, in our tradition, we don't really make a big difference between knowledge and love of God. So Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sadhya Kabunoi. So that's pure knowledge. Pure knowledge means pure love of God. But then, when a soul enters the material world, as we know, we get conditioned by the three modes of nature, the three gunas, who are compared to ropes, who influence our knowledge. And therefore, Lord Krishna speaks of the three types of knowledge. Someone else want to read some? Raise your hand. Let me volunteer, please. Three kinds of knowledge. Yeah. So knowledge contaminated or influenced by the three gunas, as opposed to pure knowledge. And in pure knowledge, we start to really understand reality as it is, and we understand fundamental categories of the world. And two very important categories, at least especially in our tradition, is this division between God and between us. Between the soul and between God, the two categories of jiva tattva, or the category of soul, and Vishnu tattva, the category of God. So I spoke a little bit on this category of soul. What is the soul? What is this category that we belong to? And so I brought this idea of Madhvacharya, who, as we know, is a precursor to the Gaudiya tradition, and he very much stressed this difference again between the soul and God, two categories. And that's why he has this hand mudra that we all recognize. That's what it symbolizes, actually. There's two things in reality, not one, as Shankaracharya was spreading so much just before him, but there's two. There's us, there's the soul, and there's God. And then I made another little intellectual joke, which people laugh, so please laugh a little bit so I can feel a little better. I said, for those of you in the audience who are experts, because every academician is super specific, they study the color of chewing gum from one company sold in one city from 1980 to 1982. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but it's that type of preciseness, right? So I said, for those who are expert in modern American history, especially the counterculture of the 60s, you may be glad to know that Madhvacharya may be one of the first examples in recorded history of the famous symbol of love and peace, or peace and love. Oh, thank you for your laughter. So back to the soul. I said there's a great Hindu scholar called C.S. Lewis. Everyone laughed again because he was a Christian writer, who supposedly said, someone want to read? That's exactly what we believe, right? The Hino Sminyata Dehe, or Aham Brahmasmi, right? Actually, he didn't say that. Somehow, this statement was attributed to him, but a researcher did the research and he never said this, which makes sense because in Christian thinking, there's no such clear-cut distinction between the self and the body, which is just a dress. You are body and mind and soul and spirit, and it gets complicated, but it's not clear-cut like in our tradition. But this is what we believe. So then I brought it to the question of the guru. Okay, the guru, we're talking about the guru here, the role of the guru in obtaining knowledge. Does the guru, where does the guru fall? In what category? Jiva, the category of soul, or the category of Vishnu? Yeah, Jiva. Inconceivable, one indifferent, or worshipped as good as, but at the ultimate sense, it's an individual soul, right? And here, I'm going to read this to you. This is two paragraphs from the Lilamrita by Satsarupa Maharaj, where he describes the first initiation ceremony in 1966 in New York. So, and now, Bhaktivedanta Swami said at length, I will tell you what is meant by initiation. Initiation means that the spiritual master accepts the student and agrees to take charge, and the student accepts the spiritual master and agrees to worship him as God. He paused. No one spoke. Any questions? He asked. And when there were none, he got up and walked out. His students were stunned. What had they just heard him say? For weeks he had stressed that when anyone claims to be God, he should be considered a dog. So, you know, I'm reading this at Harvard, where they're very, you know, mindful about what what people say. So I had to say, Bhaktivedanta Swami didn't mince his words. Because Prabhupada didn't mince his words. He spoke very, very heavily sometimes. And I guess it's our divine, sacred responsibility to make people understand those statements in the proper way so they don't get turned off. So he used to say that, right? Anyone who claims is God is a dog. Only Prabhupada could say that. So Wally says, my mind's just been blown. Everybody's mind is blown, said Howard. Swaminiji just dropped a bomb. I don't know if I want to be initiated now, Wally confessed. We have to worship him as God. So Wally and Howard went up to Swamiji's apartment. Howard asked him, Swamiji, does what you told us mean that we are supposed to accept the spiritual master to be God? Bhaktivedanta Swami replied calmly, that means he is due the same respect as God, being God's representative. Howard said, then he is not God? No, Bhaktivedanta Swami said, God is God, the spiritual master is his representative. Therefore, he is as good as God because he can deliver God to the sincere disciple. Is that clear? It was. So we established the guru in the category of jiva, and therefore, you want to someone from the lady side, Vaishnavi side, someone want to read? Come on, read. Okay, so it's not God, it's he or she. And there's a discussion, a rediscussion right now in ISKCON today about can women be spiritual masters. If you ask me, it's up to the disciple to choose who he or she wants to take initiation from. And if that person happens to be a woman and is qualified spiritually, that's the disciple's own choice and Hare Krishna. I don't think ISKCON has an institutional right to ban someone from taking initiation from someone who is in a woman's body because she happens to have a woman's body. I mean, it's a big discussion. I won't get into it. But so the spiritual master, be he or she, is in the category of jiva. So now I had to explain the second category that you gain when you have, you know, pure vision, pure knowledge. And so I'm bringing this point of Paramatma, the analogy of the two birds, right? On the far right, you have Janmastami Prabhu, the individual soul. And on the left, you have Krishna and the heart. Right? Krishna says, I am the heart. In the 13th chapter, all over the Gita, Krishna says, I am seated in everyone's heart. Or what is it? Kshitragyam chapimam vidi sarva kshitreshu bharata. In the 13th chapter, he says, I am also the knower. He's speaking about the soul, and then he says, and I am also the knower in all bodies. So there's clearly two dynamics going on, the individual soul and the super soul. And what does that super soul say in the Bhagavad Gita? Someone want to read? All All right, so the knowledge comes from Krishna. Knowledge doesn't come from the guru. The knowledge comes from Krishna. The realization comes from Krishna. So, how do we understand it? And how does the knowledge come from Krishna? So here I had to go to the Srimad Bhagavatam. If you haven't read the first canto, second chapter, verse 16 through 21, you should read it. Because those four or five verses constitute the, let's say, the crux explanation of how a soul, you know, gets free of the modes of ignorance and passion and comes to know, as Prabhupada translates, to know scientifically of the science of God. So we have these passages. Maybe someone want to read? Ben, vas-y, s'il te plaît. So remember that. By rendering service to the pure devotee, sorry, go on. I had to add that. You know, Harvard. So this pink sentence, by rendering of service to the pure devotee, in Sanskrit it's Bhagavat Sevaya, right? So by this Bhagavat Sevaya, the purification takes place. So you've got a Bhagavat, a person Bhagavat, be he or she, who's very advanced, who's acting as the guru, outside the disciple's body. The disciple serves that spiritual master. And then, according to the service that the disciple renders to the spiritual master, from within the heart, because of this Bhagavad Sevaya, from within the heart, Krishna cleanses desire for material enjoyment, which means these modes of nature, knowledge under the three modes, and makes the original pure knowledge awaken. So it's amazing how there's this relationship, like almost a contract, Paramatma inside the heart, and according to how we behave with God, with Krishna's representative, then, accordingly, from the heart, Krishna gives or doesn't give knowledge. It just shows you how much there's this culture of respect for the Vaishnavas, for devotees, right? Because how we treat devotees is how Krishna deals with us in the heart. So coming back to this Divyogyan Hride Prakashita, this is supposed to be the original handwriting of Narottam Das Thakur, by the way, which is at our Bhaktivedanta library in Calcutta. We sing every day, right? Om Agyanati Mirandasya Agyananjana Shalakaya Kshakshurun Militam Vena Tasmai Shri Gurave Nama. Narottam Das Thakur also wrote that. I didn't know. I looked it up. And so same thing, right? I was born in ignorance and my spiritual master gave me knowledge, gave me the torchlight of knowledge. So how do we understand this? When we hear so many verses like this one, which is similar to the one we read before. Anyone want to read, please? Again, it's Krishna in the heart who gives knowledge. So how do we understand Divyogyan Hride Prakashita? So this is where I took these scholars. I said, well, here for this, we have to go to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, another great saint in the Gaudiya tradition. I didn't say great saint, another saint in the Gaudiya tradition. I mean, we believe he's a great, but we're supposed to. You know, that's the thing you learn when you start trying to present Krishna consciousness in different contexts. You really start being careful with the kind of language you use. You know, like for example, Garuda Prabhu. You know, who knows Garuda Prabhu? He comes to Radhadesh often. He's an author, a really wonderful disciple of Prabhupada. He's coming in February for 3 days. He'll be speaking. So when he told me the story of how there was this new bhakta in some temple in America who went to a university to give a talk on the Bhagavad Gita. So he went, and then when he came back, he spoke to Garuda Prabhu on the phone or in person. And so Garuda Prabhu said, "So how did it go?" And then the devotee said, "Prabhu, it went horrible. It was a fiasco." So Guru Prabhu said, "Well, why?" And the devotee said, "I didn't even get a meter in the discussion. I started and I said the Bhagavad Gita is 5,000 years old. And then the professor who was there interrupted me and said, no, actually the Bhagavad Gita is not 5,000 years old, according to modern scholarship. And so I argued back, no, it is 5,000 years old. And he argued back, no, it's not 5,000 years old. And we spent the whole class arguing about the date of the Bhagavad Gita. So then Garuda Prabhu told me, he told this devotee, said, Michael, that's not the point. If the Bhagavad Gita was written yesterday, the point is to give the message of the Bhagavad Gita to these people. Of course, it's not that we're going to compromise on what we believe, but the point is, you know, we have to kind of understand what is important, what circumstance. And imagine if you said, okay, professor, according to academics, it's 5,000 years old. Now, guys, let me tell you, there's God, there's the soul. You know, we really start getting into the tofu of the presentation. So anyway, back to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, we sing every day. The seventh verse, Sakshad Dharidvena Samasta Shastre Ruktastata Bhavyata Eva Sadbi Kintu Pravorya Priya Eva Tasya. Indeed, the Guru is certainly as dear as the Lord Himself. So, as we know, I'm preaching to the choir here, and that, because you all know this, the Guru is not God, but He's worshipped as good as God because He's very dear to Krishna. And why is He very dear to Krishna? Because He is surrendered to Krishna and has no selfish desire other than the pleasure of Krishna. That's what makes a soul dear to Krishna. And so therefore, yasya prasadat bhagavat prasadat, yasya prasadat nagati kutopi. Somebody want to read? So there's this tag team, this équipe between two individuals. There's a tag team, a team. Tag team is a word you use in professional wrestling. You know, somebody's in the ring, and then he taps, and then the guy comes out, and the other guy comes in to beat up the opponent. So there's a tag team relationship between Krishna in the heart and the Guru outside. And together, they basically destroy the ignorance of the disciple. So, you know, come on, laugh, please, guys. They laughed, at least, you know, demolition team. And this is how I basically ended my lecture. And my point was that, okay, this verse by Narottam Das Thakur, where he says, Divya Gyan Ride Prakashita, doesn't actually represent very clear-cut, ontological, scriptural truths. It's an expression of love. That's the only way I can explain it. That the Guru is so dear to Krishna and therefore so close to Krishna almost in identity, although he's not Krishna. That, and even though it's Krishna who gives the knowledge from the heart, c'est kif kif bourrico, as we say in French. It's just as quoi. It's the same thing as if it was the Guru. Because of that such tight bond of contract between Krishna and his representative. And so that's why Narottam Das Thakur sings, He fills my heart with transcendental knowledge. So that's how I concluded the talk. I was going to go further in discussing the form of the soul, how in the spiritual world, you know, the spiritual master is meditated upon. The spiritual master is meditated upon in his spiritual swarup, right, in his ontological form, and in this case is that of a manjari who's assisting Srimati Radharani in serving Krishna. And so you have this incredible thing that's actually very unique to our tradition, is that you have a guru or a great acharya who has a physical, quote-unquote, material body, let's say in this case, male, which is most of the cases in our tradition, you know, who is buried in a particular place in samadhi, who has, you know, a clear male physical form. And yet, the disciple prays. You want to read, Prabhu?
This is my desire to join the company of the Gopi friends and the divine father. Oh, my master, by your mercy, only can my desire be fulfilled. Oh, my master, I wish to have your association when you manifest your form as a Gopi friend of the divine father. Oh, master, when, by your mercy, will I be allowed to serve the Lord? Please be merciful to me and bless me that Father Krishna's love is with me.
So here you have Narottam Das Thakur, who sees his spiritual master in his meditation as one of these ladies, either on the right or the left of Srimati Radharani, and who is assisting Srimati Radharani, serving Srimati Radharani. And even though, as we saw just before, the spiritual master has a physical form of a male human, still, the disciple meditates on his spiritual master in his original spiritual form, as that of a Manjari. So that's amazing, you know. That's actually, if there's anything that we have that other traditions don't have in common with the Gaudiya tradition, it's this. The idea of a soul has a spiritual form, specific, you know, the size of the length of the hair, the color of the skirt or the sari, the specific service, you know. Now, just to put things in the context of ISKCON and Prabhupada and Prabhupada's general mood, we can finish with this statement by Prabhupada. I'll read it. Gopis, they are not conditioned souls. They are liberated spirits. So, first of all, you have to come out from this conditioned life. Then the question of serving Gopi will come. Don't be at the present moment very eager to serve Gopi. Just try to get out of your conditional life. Then time will come when you'll be able to serve Gopi. In this conditional stage, we cannot serve anything. Krishna is performing it, everything. But Krishna gives us opportunities to accept service in this Archa Marg. Just like we keep the deity of Krishna, offer prasad under regulation, under principle. So we have to make advance in this way, this chanting, hearing, and worshipping in the temple, arti, offering prasad. In this way, as we make advance, then automatically Krishna will reveal to you and you'll understand your position. How you have to... Gopis means who are always constantly engaged in the service of the Lord. So that eternal relationship will be revealed. So we have to wait for that. Immediately we cannot imitate serving gopis. That's a good idea that you shall serve gopi, but it will take time, not immediately. Immediately we have to follow the rules and regulations and routine work. That's why we chant Hare Krishna. But it's nice to know, to remind ourselves what is the goal and what is the big picture of our tradition, and in this case, what's the role of the spiritual master in obtaining knowledge. Voilà, Monsieur Dame, thank you. I hope you liked it. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. What do we do now? A question or two, a comment, or stop? Or Prabhu? Do you want to turn the light on, please? Uh-oh.
Yes, because it's like a question about society to try to be equal, man and woman equal.
I don't know if you want to get into this because it's a big discussion, and I think we have 2 minutes. Yeah, but if you make that statement, then someone, or at least me or someone, will want to probably give a rebuttal to what you're saying, because what you're saying probably has been already said by thoughtful thinkers. So I don't know if we want to get into that discussion. Yeah, you want to hear? I'm your servant. I'm just a facilitator of the general devotee's desire here. So. Yeah, well, Bhakti Vikash Maharaj. That explains a lot. With all due respect to Bhakti Vikash Maharaj. Well, I'll tell you frankly, personally, as a conditioned soul in a male body, I would have difficulty accepting a spiritual master who happens to be a woman, not because of her qualification, just because of my male macho nature. If I was married, I would have a difficulty having a wife who's initiating disciples, when I would hope maybe sometimes she would maybe serve me prasadam, you know. So there's definitely a tension there, you know, between varnashram considerations and purely notions of initiation, of transcendental knowledge and giving spiritual guidance. I'm looking at it, though, traditionally, in our tradition, though, I don't think we can say that it's never happened. It has, even if it was Janava, Janava Devi, who was an expansion of Radharani. And so the fact is that Prabhupada himself used that example when he was asked the question. In other words, they asked Prabhupada, can women initiate? He said, yes, of course, Janava. Okay, she was Nityananda's wife, Vishnu Tattva or Shakti Tattva, but why did Prabhupada use that example? To say yes. That in itself, whether it kind of minimizes what she is, because whatever she is, the answer is to the question is, can women initiate? He said yes, and he gives an example, or two. And there's more examples in Janava. There's names, those Gangamata Goswamini, and so on. Now, if it's always been the case that it's a small minority, I think it's going to continue to be a small minority. I don't think we have to be afraid that all of a sudden there's going to be an army, a legion of women gurus. And ultimately, the most important thing is, I think ISKCON's duty is not to go into householders' houses and make sure they're wearing kopins instead of underwear, or whether they're waking up at 4:20 and not 5:15, and so on. In other words, a sort of micromanagement of every devotee's life, especially in the context of devotees who are financially independent of ISKCON, which is 90%+ of the ISKCON community. They're not monks. They don't depend on ISKCON financially. They have their own life with their own spiritual inspirations, right? So in the context of a social world like this, even if you wanted to have a policy, a draconian policy that no woman can initiate, it's almost the equivalent of having this sort of policy that, okay, we will somehow have spies to go into the homes of all the grihasthas to make sure that, they're offering whatever, rice without, like specific things that it's just physically impossible to Gestapo style kind of thing. So I kind of attribute Gestapo or KGB. So the idea is not whether ISKCON should choose, okay, you are a woman, you initiate, or you are a woman, you don't initiate. The question is, okay, there's devotees at grassroots who want to take initiation from a Vaishnavi in ISKCON. The question is, do we allow them to take initiation from a Vaishnavi? Not do we allow the Vaishnavi to initiate. I mean, it's almost the same thing, but it's subtle, because the focus is actually on the demand, not on the supply. What do we do with the demand? There's a demand. Whether they're completely off track with Varnashram, that's their choice. As a spiritual master, you can say, yes, you should follow the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam clearly says Sri Dharma, woman's duty is to serve the husband, and so on. And that's the Bhagavatam. We accept the Bhagavatam as the Amala Purana, the spotless Purana. So, will there be a Krishna conscious, let's say, couple or family who is probably happier in their life if they follow a very, Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavatam centered lifestyle at home? Probably. I would say yes, because that's the Bhagavatam, non-different from Krishna. However, it's their personal life. And in terms of who they want to take initiation from and what sort of a lifestyle they want, as leaders of ISKCON, the only thing you can really manage is, okay, are they chanting, is the person that they want to take initiation from chanting 16 rounds? Does that person know Prabhupada's books very well? Can that person spread Krishna consciousness, explain Krishna consciousness on the basis of Prabhupada's books? If the answer to those three questions are yes, I personally don't see any justification for having a draconian policy banning women straight up to give initiation. I hope that's okay. Hare Krishna. You asked me, so I didn't come here to speak about that. Right. Like Mother Urmila, to be frank, she's a grandmother. She's already severed her relationship with her husband. And Prabhupada, so philosophically, I don't think there's any justification, specifically in terms of, pure Bhagavad philosophy, which is really what we're about, much more so than Dharma Shastra as of Manu Samhita and so on. We're about the final authority of the Bhagavatam, of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, of the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement. That's what we're about, first and foremost. First and foremost, not saying other things are not important, but that's what we really have control over and what we should really emphasize. And we have control over in terms of membership. But then, what control do you have over how people want to live their Krishna consciousness in their own privacy of their lives? You can give lectures, you can speak, but you can't implement policies about how they're going to serve their husbands or not, or how they're going to offer their food, or what kind of food they're going to offer to Krishna, or what time they're going to wake up in the morning, or all these things. That's really in the category of the person's life, especially if they're not financially dependent on ISKCON. It's very important to remember. And quite frankly, Prabhupada was concerned. If you read, Prabhupada was very much concerned about what people think about ISKCON, what people think. So this thing is, we don't care what people say in the world. They're all demons anyway. And we're going to push on with our convictions. That's not very intelligent preaching at all. And one thing is to lie and to compromise core principles for the sake of pleasing the people. That's what we don't want to do. But doing something which is within the framework of our theology, which Prabhupada himself did say yes to, you can very well argue not to do that in the face of a world where, okay, for better or for worse, yes, there's equality between men and women. That's the world we live in, Prabhu. That's the world we want to transform. That's the world we want to transform. We're not rejecting that world and going to the Himalayas. That's what Krishna's given us in 2013. That's what we're dealing with. So let's make that world Krishna conscious. And a good way to make that world Krishna conscious is by responding to a desire of people to want to take initiation from a woman if she's qualified to do it. Yeah, since you asked me, that's my opinion. Anything else? All right, well, you want to, Jamas, somebody want to lead kirtan for a few minutes? Oh, for the kirtan?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, once again, forgive me for any offenses. Thank you for your time. And, Hare Krishna. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Yeah, I cannot see.